Welcome to Commons and Chronicles, the podcast where we talk about all the best Creative Commons and reusable open game license content. If you need resources for your creative writing, game design, or you just love lore, Commons and Chronicles is for you. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu, and this is another entry, probably the last entry, into the H.P. Lovecraft's Dreamland Realm series, or mini-series, such as it is. In this episode, I want to talk about Lang. We've heard a lot about Lang. We've met merchants from Lang. We've seen people of Lang on the moon. Heard that Lang is a dark and mysterious land where there lies great evil. Well, today we're going to go there. We're going to check it out. We're going to find out what's really going on in Lang. And after Lang, we will stop in to the very place from which the source text takes its title, Caedith. Now, because all of this is basically the culmination of the story, of the source text, this is kind of where everything reaches its head. A lot of things are revealed here. If you intend to go read the book, then you should do that before listening to this episode. There are, just by the nature of where we are in the book, a lot of potentially spoilery information that will just, everything here will ruin the story for you, but there are a lot of things that are just not really clear until you get here. And for me as the reader, that was one of the real pleasures of the story was all these threads sort of finally coming together. It's not like loose ends are being tied up exactly, because it's not really all that loose-ended. It's a pretty straight shot through the story. It's just kind of your surroundings becoming more developed and you getting a better feel for the world. So this will spoil that experience for you if you continue to listen. Consider yourself warned. So Lang is a mysterious land that some refuse to believe even exists, and those who do generally feel that it's just an evil place to be avoided. Its evil fires are seen at night from afar, and it is rumored that a merchant in Dilith Lean had, long ago, crossed paths and possibly even will with a high priest who is not to be described, but is clad in a yellow silken mask and dwells all alone in a prehistoric stone monastery. So there are those who believe Lang exists. There are those who believe it doesn't exist. Everyone pretty much agrees it should be left alone. At the peaks of Lang's mountain range that kind of surround it are strange caves, similar to those that you would find on Granach, on Mount Granach. But even the fearful Shantak birds, who we learned about in a previous episode, avoid these caves, because the dreaded night gaunts are known to lurk there. Now, what lies within these yawning portals is unknown, and I think in the source text we never find out. They may go down to the Great Abyss, or they may be portals to other worlds, to other places outside of this Dreamland realm. It's really up to you. It could be a dungeon in there, it could be anything. So, we do know that the Night Gaunts kind of hang out there, but we don't know anything more than that. And granted, because the Night Gaunts are there, you might think, well, it's probably just another cave system down to the Great Abyss, because that's what we know of the Night Gaunts, is that they like to take things down to the Great Abyss. But for me, in my head canon, I think there's a lot more to those caves. I don't think it's just another way down to the Great Abyss. That seems stale. I think it probably goes, I like to think that there were entries into different realities. So, like if you subscribe to any kind of planar system, you know, as in traditional D&D, then maybe the Dreamland world is kind of that interstitial plane between different realities. So you could go into one cave and you'd come out the other side in Kryn, in Dragonlance, or you'd pop out in a different cave and you'd go into a different cave and pop out in Hyboria or Torel, or Tortle, however you say that, or wherever. So for me, that's what they are. But the source text simply says that they're caves and that they are guarded by night gaunts. So despite its evil reputation, Lang's history is actually one of great oppression, and it's a little bit sad. So Lang was held what was a great seaport at first, you know, long, long ago. The seaport was called Sarkomand, and it sat between proud and pillared cliffs with basalt wharves and high fanes and carven places. Great gardens and columned streets led from the cliffs, and from each of the six sphinx-crowned gates to a vast central plaza, and in that plaza there stood a pair of great winged colossal lions. And these lions guard now, as they did in the past, the outlet of a great subterranean stairway, which goes down to who knows where. We don't ever find out. We assume it goes to the Great Abyss, but we don't know. But we believe that it goes down to the Great Abyss because the ghouls, when they helped the narrator of the story, they mention that one way through the realm is through Lang. So you could go down, presumably down this great stairway into the Great Abyss, and then end up, you know, if you survived the Great Abyss, or, you know, the Underdark for D&D devotees, then you could find your way back up to where the ghouls came from in the first place. So that's kind of what we're assuming, although we don't know. There could just be a cave somewhere in Lang that goes to the Great Abyss. So we don't actually know what the Great Stairway goes down to, but there are assumptions being made. But it is up to interpretation. So long, long, long ago, Lang was a battleground for a war between the great purple spiders of Lang and the I guess the almost humans. I was going to say the humanoids of Lang, but they're consistently called almost humans. So we will call them almost humans. The spiders of Lang are giant spiders, and they actually get statted out in one of my go-to bestiaries, the Tome of Beasts by, you guessed it, Kobold Press. So in their Tome of Beasts on page, it looks like it's page 366, 65, sorry, there's an entry for Spider of Lang. And it's a pretty good stat block, I would say. It's Spiders of Lang, let's see, large aberration, chaotic evil, that is about right, I think. Armor class, 15 natural armor, hit points, 144, that's 17d10 plus 51. Speed is 30 feet with a climb speed of 20 feet. Strength 14, so that's plus 2. Dex 16 plus 3. Con is 16 plus 3. Intelligence is 17 plus 3. Wisdom is 10. Charisma is 10. Saving throws. Dex plus 6. Int plus 6. Their skills are athletics plus 5. Perception plus 3. Stealth plus 6. They have damage resistance to poison, and they have condition immunities to being charmed, being poisoned, obviously, or being unconscious. Senses, they have dark vision up to 240 feet, and then passive perception of 13. So not an easy foe to kind of get around. It's and not an easy foe to just take on directly either. So what fun. Languages, common and void speech. The challenge rating of these a spider is 7. So they're definitely creatures that that are worthy opponents. You don't want to throw them at low levels. Some of their little their skills are, they have hate humanoids. The nefarious spiders of Lang are highly intelligent. They are a very ancient race, steeped in evil lore and hideous malice, with an abiding hatred for all humanoid races. They sometimes keep ghost walk spiders as guardians or soldiers. Ghost walk spider obviously being a different entry in the Tome of Beasts, which I will not go through, but I love the idea that these spiders are, that they're structured, you know, they have a structured army. They're not just a bunch of wild spiders who went and ate the almost humans. They're a formidable force of you know, an actual army with structure and ranks. I love, of course, that they've got dangerous blood. So their blood is poisonous and corrosive to most creatures native to the material plane. The folk of Lang prize it in making harpoons and enchanted nets. That's cool, but not in the book. That's purely Tome of Beasts flavor. They have Eldritch Understanding, so they can read and use scrolls. They have innate spell casting, so they can cast spells. They have Poisonous Blood, Shocking Riposte. When a Spider of Lang casts Shield, it can also make a Shocking Grasp attack for 9, that is 2d8 lightning damage, against one enemy within 5 feet as part of the same reaction. They've got a multi-attack skill as well, where they they can do either two claw attacks or two staff attacks, or one of each. And in the Tome of Beasts, the Spiders of Lang have these sort of electrical staff weapons that they're wielding in their prehensile claws. So that's, again, not really detailed in the source text, but it's kind of a cool decoration. Their claws do melee, the count as a melee weapon attack. It's a +6 to hit, I guess because they have so many legs with which to hit. And it's a reach of 5 foot for each target. A hit is a 14, that's 2d10 plus 3, slashing damage plus 4, 1d8, poison damage. Spit Venom, ranged weapon attack, +5 to hit, range 60 feet. That's pretty wicked. A hit is 3d8 plus 3 poison damage, and the target must make a successful DC 14 constitution saving throw or be poisoned and blinded until the end of its next turn. And as I say, they've got this staff that they wield in the Tome of Beasts. It's not in the book, but it's a melee weapon, +5 to hit, the reach of 5 foot. It targets one creature. The hit is 9 or 2d6 plus 2. Bludgeoning damage plus 13, that's 2d12 psychic damage, and the target must make a successful DC 15 wisdom saving throw or be stunned until the start of the spider's next turn. They have some reactions, and that is Ancient Hatred. When reduced to 0 HP, the Spider of Lang makes one final spit venom attack before dying. Really, really mean creature. Very, very formidable. And I think it fits. It really suits, because Lang is supposed to be an evil and a dangerous place. And these spiders really reduced the ancient civilization of Lang near to the brink of complete failure. And as if that wasn't enough, once the spiders had been defeated, or maybe they hadn't been defeated, maybe this outside force defeated the spiders and the almost humans, I'm not really sure, but at some point, again, this is all ancient history, but at some point, black galleys sailed into the harbor from the moon, presumably, and it was the moon beasts, and they subdued the people of Lang into submission, subjecting them to the polypus and amorphous blasphemies that hopped and floundered and wriggled out of the ships. Those slippery grayish-white moon beasts were worshipped as gods, and then these gods demanded a steady supply of Lang's best and fatted males, who were taken away in the black ships, never to be seen again. We've heard all about that, of course. And the history, as detailed on the walls of this ancient monastery, that's where we get the battle with the spiders and the ultimate fall under the hands of the moon beasts. It's something that's described, but the details are not really provided. So maybe the moon beasts were worshipped as gods because they defeated the spiders, and the almost humans figured, well, that's pretty cool, we've been saved, only to be then enslaved. Or maybe they came in and demanded to be worshipped as gods. We don't know, and that would be up to the DM to decide how that's going to play out, or how that played out anyway. So much of Lang lies in waste now, because they were defeated essentially twice, once by the spiders and then once by the moon beasts. But there are lone huts of granite and bleak stone in little villages kind of scattered around here and there, with tiny little windows that glow with pallid light. So there is some sign of light. And these just kind of exist lonely out there on the great cold desert plateaus of Lang. From such huts and villages, the shrill droning of pipes and a nauseous rattle of Crotala can be heard day and night. Although few adventurers dare enter Lang, anyone who does would see all around the feeble fires the dark forms of Lang folk dancing to the vile music and rhythms. Now, this is code in Lovecraft's language for some kind of connection to Nyarlathotep or Azathoth or something like that, some chaotic force, some elder god. We don't know exactly what, but I would bet money that it was Nyarlathotep. In the east of Lang are white hemispherical buildings on curious knolls, which common folklore associates unpleasantly with the other gods and their crawling chaos, Nyarlathotep. So it's legend that it's Nyarlathotep who has control over Lang now. Neither Night Gaunts nor ghouls will venture that far, and no adventurer has either. So there's something going on the very, very, very far reaches of Lang, and no one knows what it is. Let's talk a little bit about Sarkomand. Sarkomand was the big bustling trade city that made Lang famous back in the ancient old days. Sarkomand now is a deserted city lying in a valley below Greater Lang, where black nitrous stairways guarded by winged diorite lions lead down from the dreamland to the lower gulfs. It was the capital city of Lang at one point, and among the ruins of fallen Sarkomand lies a remote and prehistoric monastery containing a solitary high priest who prays to the other gods and their crawling chaos near Nyarlathotep. The priest is known only as the, quote, high priest not to be described, and all that can be said of this priest is that he wears, or it wears, a yellow silken mask over its face. The monastery is constructed of uncouth stones and in a squat windowless building around which a circle of crude monoliths stand. In all this arrangement, there is nothing human. The pillars around the monastery form a great circular plaza, and it is on either side of this plaza that the lions, those diorite lions, stand guarding the stairway. So the monastery is near the subterranean stairway. If you were to go inside the monastery, you would find its entrance a literal maze. It's somewhere that if you don't know where you're going, you could easily be lost. Of course, there's no light either, so it's completely dark. You would have to take a torch, or you would have to have dark vision, which in 5th edition certainly pretty much everything has dark vision, as far as I can tell, but in previous editions, a little bit rare. So you'd need some form of light in order to go through here. It is a literal maze. On the walls is all the history of Lang, which everything that the walls contain in the book I've already described to you: the battle with the spiders and the enslavement to the moon beasts, and the colonization of the Jagged Isle. So it's all there. But presumably there's quite a lot more on those walls, and that could be a source of great entertainment. The maze that is the entrance to the monastery is essentially a dungeon, really. I mean, it's got winding corridors, it has changing, you know, stairs for no reason, and then ramps to other levels that then end up back where you started. There are little there are entries and exits, you know, places that you could crawl and get into who knows where. So it is exactly what you would want if you wanted a dungeon crawl to occur. It's right there. There's not obviously a whole lot of detail written about this, I mean, in terms of a map, but it's something that you could absolutely very easily form into a dungeon without having to stretch the imagination of this world at all. It's pre-written as this is a dungeon. The inner sanctum of the monastery is a great domed space with walls carved in shocking bas-relief. In the center, there's a gaping circular pit surrounded by 6 malignly stained stone altars in a ring. At the farthest end is a high stone dais reached by 5 steps and a magnificent golden throne. That which claims the throne today is a lumpish figure robed in yellow silk, figured in red and with a yellow mask over its face. It is rumored that the high priest is actually a moon beast, as it was reported by one adventurer, specifically the narrator of the source text, that the priest's hand is actually a grayish-white paw. But nobody can be sure, because no one's actually seen behind the priest's veil or robes. I think, because the only real enemy in the source text are the moon beasts, I think that that's probably what Lovecraft was going for, is that the priest was a moon beast ruling over Lang. But I sincerely am not sure. It is a grayish-white paw, sort of, that appears to be sort of sticking out of the robe when the priest takes something that someone is giving to him or it. But it's not expressly explained, so there's some wiggle room there if that doesn't suit. There's one passage of note in the corridors. It's the actual exit from this place, and it's an almost hidden chute that takes a traveler out of the monastery or wherever an adventurer has found themselves in the winding corridors back down to the Plaza of Pillars outside. So that is one, there is one escape exit that we know of because the narrator of the story took it. The priest of Lang doesn't really, the priest not to be described, isn't really, it's not a whole lot of, to go off of. There's not much given about this priest other than he strikes terror into the hearts of anyone who goes near him, or any non-evil creature that goes near him. So you can pretty much just take any given priest slash wizard slash whatever suits your fancy and make that the priest. It doesn't really matter. The one thing that I would probably insist on myself is that there needs to be a fear check or something to combat some kind of, you know, psychic or emotional influence that this priest has over a player. So that's Lang. Although Lang, it really is kind of on the edge of the world. It's on the edge of civilization, at least. And remember that Lang is technically either a part of or adjacent to Inquinoc, which always has fascinated me, because Inquinoc is supposed to be this extremely godlike, you know, half-god region, and yet it's right next to Lang, like this evil, evil place being ruled over by some invader from another plane or world or whatever. But it's right there, and then beyond that is basically the end of this realm, which is protected by watchful Shantax. So no one has gone that far through Lang. Although, if you befriend Night Gaunts, you could get the Night Gaunts to take you past the Shantax, because the Shantax hate Night Gaunts. Anyway, in this region, it kind of seems that reality starts to break down. The figures of constellations appear different than they do elsewhere. Some say that they're not different, and that they're just that they're sort of communicating to you almost, that they're revealing some kind of significance that you couldn't see out, you know, from just the normal parts of the realm. So that's kind of interesting to me. The idea that once you get to a certain point, reality itself starts to talk to you, sort of like turn back or go this way or something. I don't know what the stars would be saying, but that's kind of cool. That the very fabric of reality starts to sort of become flexible and communicative. Everything here in this far region focuses towards the north. Every yawning cleft and fantastically erratic pinnacle, every turning and inclination of the grotesque outline of the mountain peaks themselves, every curve and asterism of the glittering sky becomes part of a vast design whose function is to hurry first the eye and then the whole observer onward to some secret and terrible goal of convergence beyond the frozen waste that stretches endlessly ahead. I'm pretty sure that's a direct quote from Lovecraft, unless I wrote that description down from what he said. Either way, it's everything is pulling someone who comes that far. They are almost enchanted, one might say, to go further. And whether that's a good thing or not is completely up to maybe the die, who knows, at the very best of the DM. So in this region, there lies an assortment of abhorrent giants. It's not known whether they are forgotten gods or they're just huge abominations, but at least some of them are hyena-like, taller than mountains, though, bearing double heads with a frightful swollen body, walking impossibly in stealth and silence. And these giants, they will stalk their prey. So if you are traveling through this region and you maybe make a successful perception check, you might see out of the corner of your eye that one of these things that you thought was just another mountain in a mountain range in the distance seems to be moving along with you as you go. And eventually you might have to confront it because they are quite stealthy and they will follow you. And who knows what they want of you, but they are known to stalk adventurers who go that far. So eventually this sort of quasi end of the world region gives way to a kind of vortex of chaotic wind. And where this vortex leads, none can say. Well, of course we can say, although adventurers who once flew above it were sucked out into space. So that's presumably where the vortex takes you, is out into the great void, into the gulf, as Lovecraft calls it. So we've talked sort of about the gulf a little bit early on, So I'm not going to talk too much about that now because we've covered this information before. The Gulf is, of course, it's outer space, basically. It's the place where the elder gods, deep into this gulf, the elder gods live. And within this gulf, there are the larvae, if you remember, of gods that I guess don't exist yet, or of godlike creatures. We're not really clear on what they are because I'm not really sure what a god larva is exactly, but that's where these things lie. And it's a horrible place. It's a scary place. It is where Azathoth lives. And Azathoth, of course, is constantly seeking to devour the whole of reality. Azathoth is, I guess, in a weird way, the Mana Yud Sushai of Lovecraft, except he's really a lot hungrier and angrier than Mana Yud Sushai came across. And Azathoth is not, I don't believe, sleeping like Mana Yud Sushai is, but Azathoth is either waiting or being subdued enough that he cannot devour the whole of reality, but that is what he wants. Also out here dwells Snigak, the old god consisting of nothing but a purple gas out in space, sort of like a nebula, I guess. That's S-N-G-A-C. And of course, the devotees of Nyarlathotep are here as well. So skipping over the gulf, which, I mean, not only have I covered it, but that's basically all that Lovecraft really says about it, too. We'll go straight to Kadath. And Kadath is confusing. I think, as I stated early on, Kadath appears to be both a palace, but also a city. It's the text is very much unclear about the extent of Kadath. So by the end of the source text, Kadath has sort of become just this one palace. But throughout, it seems to be something either on the border of a city or maybe that it encompasses a city. We're not really sure. So whatever Kadath is, at least some part of it is a huge palace that was built by the gods. It lies outside of reality, and it is reachable only through the Great Void, or the Gulf, whatever we want to call it. Kadath, if not a realm itself, is some place that the gods reserve unto themselves. Whether they ever want to use the city again, or whether they've forgotten about it, or whether they've just set it aside for some reason, or whether it was taken from them, we're not really clear. We are told a version of a story, but we, for reasons that maybe I'll leave nebulous for now at least, we're not really sure if that's the true story or not. So whether Kadath is a realm all its own, or whether it's a palace, or whether it's a city within a palace, or whether it's the city and the palace, whatever it is, it has a reputation for haunting people. If you lay eyes upon Kadath, it will haunt you forever. And you may not even be sure that it was ever real, but you will have a desire to return to it, whether or not it was real. So it's got an addictive quality, and I think that sort of thing demands a wisdom or a fortitude sort of check to see that, you know, to see if you can maybe perceive it, or whether you can shake its influence off, something along those lines. It should have a profound effect on people. So Kadath, by the end of the book, is very much synonymous with this one specific place, the Onyx Palace. It's this fabulous, incredible home of the Great Ones, an onyx castle atop unknown Kadath. Kadath itself, again, we're not clear on what it is, but I'm assuming around this palace there is a city, and this must be the Sunset City, and the Sunset City appears golden in the sunset, and it seems that it is always sunset in the city. Its wide streets are lined with delicate trees, urns filled with flowers, and rows of ivory statues. The city is elaborate, with gleaming walls, several temples, colonnades, and arched bridges of veined marble, fountains with silver basins, great public squares, and beautiful flower gardens. The entrance to the great city was created by the Fey folk, and although humans may stand upon the entrance terrace overlooking the city, it's not possible to enter the city except with permission from the gods themselves. The north section of the Sunset City is a hilly region, with tiers of buildings with red roofs, peaked gables, and little lanes of grassy cobbles. The castle is surrounded by mountain peaks, and itself is constructed of vast, looming, tenebrous towers, blasphemous in their immensity. Its stones were quarried by nameless, gigantic workmen in the horrible gulf in the upper north of Inquinoc. So if you'll recall from the Inquinoc episode, there were quarries, and there were these huge, huge blocks of stone that had been removed. And one could only surmise that the miners who had done this were giants. And indeed, yes, they were giants, and they were mining to build this palace. The Elder Gods don't live in this palace anymore, although the palace is guarded by an avatar of Nyarlathotep, who dwells there in the form of a pharaoh, basically. Nyarlathotep holds court in the loftiest tower, the highest one. Inside the castle are vast walls that shoot forever upward, great gates, Titan courtyards, and huge arched portals. Vortices of cold wind surge dankly through sightless labyrinths of onyx, leading to stairs and corridors and endless aerial twisting. It seems everything in the castle is forever leading upward, and so it's accompanied by the ever-present threat of a fateful plunge downward into darkness. The only room in use, much less lit, in the palace is at the top of the highest tower, where Nyarlathotep holds his court. It is so large in its boundaries that even as you stand inside it, you cannot see opposite walls, because you look and your vision just kind of gets enveloped by these mists that hide the farthest walls from your view. It's just so big. When Nyarlathotep does hold an audience, he is announced by three hideous blasts of a demon trumpet. It is said that when the echoes of the third blast dies away, you've been transported into a solitary realm where Nyarlathotep finds reality. So, in other words, when you travel into this tower, there are mists all around you, which, if you know anything about D&D lore, mists almost always means you're getting somewhere near the border of where planes meet. I mean, it's not hard-coded into the rules, but if you've been around, you know that mists are often the code word for planar intersection. So, that's here too. So there's a bunch of mists in this room. It's too big to see the ends of. You're in this huge, huge tower, impossibly high up in the sky. You've gotten here through traveling through, probably through a void. And then you hear these three sounds of a trumpet, of a demonic trumpet, and you are transported into Nyarlathotep's own private plane. At that point, a rhythmic trumpeting begins, a low fanfare echoing all the wonder and melody of an ethereal dream of exotic vistas with unimagined loveliness floating from each strange chord and subtly alien cadence. Odors of incense come to match the golden notes, and overhead a great light dawns with colors changing in cycles unknown to Earth's spectrum. So colors you don't even know exist, you're going to see in this realm. Out of the thinning mists and clouds of strange incense file twin columns of slaves, dressed only in loincloths of iridescent silk. Upon their heads are strapped vast helmet-like torches of glittering metal, from which the fragrance of obscure balsams spread in fumous spirals. In their right hands they carry crystal wands, whose tips are carven into leering chimeras, or chimeras, while their left hands grasp long thin silver trumpets, which they blow in rhythmic order. Now, if you know anything about ancient Egypt, which sometimes I pretend like I do, you may know that ancient trumpets were not, you know, the trumpets of today, of course, are twisted around so that there's more space for the air to go through. Ancient trumpets weren't twisted like that. They were just long tubes. And that's what a trumpet was at that time. You'll possibly hear those if you go see a production of the opera Aida by Verdi. He supposedly, in the original production of that, he used these sort of historically accurate trumpets for the introductory fanfare. It's really, really magnificent. So these slaves are carrying those. So this is all kind of out of some form of ancient Egypt. It's really, really cool. They wear armlets and anklets of gold, and between each pair of anklets stretch a golden chain that holds its wearers to a sober gait. So these are definitely slaves. These are not privileged people who are preceding a great and noble god. These are slaves. Their chains are gold, but they're slaves. These are slaves taken from Earth by the moon beasts, specifically provided to Nyarlathotep. And we more or less know that from the moon in the source text. You actually get really close to Nyarlathotep whilst on the moon. So Nyarlathotep's preferred avatar, at least in this setting, is a tall, slim figure with the young face of an ancient pharaoh. He's elegantly dressed in prismatic robes and crowned with a golden pschent that glows with inherent light. Nyarlathotep himself is truly chaotic evil in the best of ways. He really is. This character has got to be my favorite character in the book. He is exactly what you want him to be. I mean, he could be, I guess, even more evil if you're really into sort of like, the Joker style, just like let's rip things to shred and then laugh, that sort of thing. Nyarlathotep doesn't do quite that, but the entire time in this chapter, you'll come to learn that Nyarlathotep is chaotic evil, and that's all I'll say, so that I'm not spoiling absolutely everything for you. But if you read the source text and want to talk about Nyarlathotep, feel free to shoot me an email, because I think it's really a really fun part of the book. He's all about destruction. He's all about foiling the other gods, about seizing power from out from under anyone who has it. It's really, really solid. So the final stop along the path of the source text, I guess, would be Vega and potentially beyond. The brightest star in the outer realms of the Dreamland realms is Vega. 2 hours from Cadeth, at least by Nightgaunt, toward Vega, lilting music can be heard, but this music is a siren that lures adventurers into eternal captivity. The great altar flame of the Temple of Iridna is visible from space, and it is a safety beacon leading travelers lured by the music back to reality. So, in other words, if you're headed toward Vega, you're going to hear music that wants you to continue forward into Vega. If you do that, you are captured forever in Vega. There is no escape from Vega. You are there forever. We don't know what Vega's like, but there is a temple, the Temple of Iridna, that you can see back in the Six Kingdoms. You can see it from space. It is the only safety beacon that you will have to get back to the Six Kingdoms. If you cannot resist the music luring you toward Vega, or you cannot see Iridna's temple, then you're probably going to be captured forever within Vega. Now, beyond Vega dwells Azathoth and Snegak and the other gods and the larva of other gods, and all those other evil beings. According to Nyarlathotep, and we don't know if this is true because Nyarlathotep, spoiler, is not to be trusted, he says that the other gods have gone to live in a pleasant little city somewhere, and that if you could go to that city and kind of talk to them and remind them of how great reality is, they could return. They could come back and everything would be peachy keen. We don't know if that's true, but that's what Nyarlathotep tells us. So there you go. That is The World of the Six Kingdoms by H.P. Lovecraft. Everything I could find on it, pretty much, aside from an official pantheon or anything like that. The official Lovecraft pantheon is interesting, and it might be something that I may want to do an episode on eventually. I think it would be a little bit difficult, though. I mean, I'm sure that there is an official, well, official would be Lovecraft. So I'm sure there is a pantheon out there for Lovecraft, built around Lovecraft's gods. However, I think a lot of that would probably require heavy, heavy amounts of interpretation, because Lovecraft just isn't, he's not super detailed, which I think is one of the reasons why this source text is so very, very intriguing, because it's just in compared to a lot of his other stuff, it has a lot of information about his world. So it's definitely something that would be cool to explore, but I do feel like it would be relying on a lot of made up things. And that's kind of why, in terms of in my search for elder gods, I think Pagana by Lord Dunsany is probably the more reliably official version of an elder god pantheon than maybe Lovecraft. Although Lovecraft's is very satisfyingly a lot darker and sort of apathetic and all that other stuff. So there's a line to be walked, and maybe we'll walk it together in a future episode. For now, though, that is the Six Kingdoms, the Dreamland Realms. It's a really, really fun place. If nothing else, it provides a pretty good geography. So if you're playing in a world and you just have no idea where things should appear and how your land should be laid out, you could do worse than just kind of refer back to Lovecraft and make that the layout of your world. It's not a horrible thing to do. I've done it, and it works out pretty well for me. The details are fun in the source text. A lot of people haven't read this thing because it's weird, and for a Lovecraft story, it's pretty long. I mean, it's basically a book, and he's more famous for his short stories, I feel, so it's one of those things that a lot of people just can't quite wrap their head around. So if you use this as the basis for a world, you know, fantasy or sci-fi, I think a lot of people won't, you know, they may get bits and pieces of inspiration here and there, or identify that you got bits and pieces of inspiration from Lovecraft and kind of recognize that, but I don't think they'll recognize it too quickly. But it'll have that air of familiarity if they know Lovecraft, which is kind of cool. So yeah, it's a great place. It's a fun place to read about. It's a fun place to play a game in, and a fun place to build a world upon. I hope you enjoyed this mega series of a tour through the Six Kingdoms. I've tried to be obviously as detailed as I possibly can be, but collecting all the information into bite size and somewhat logical chunks. So hopefully it's been helpful to you. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as not Klaatu. I'm on the Freenode network. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.